Hi everyone, I'm Steve.
Or Al,
you can call me Al. That's a song. So we're talking a little bit today about active learning, or AL, as Steve likes to refer to it in a derogatory sense. You'll have seen from the material that Steve sent around that he's not a huge fan of the term, or at least the way in which it's used. Steve asked me to talk a little bit to begin with, just to set the scene, to talk about Huey, who I'm sure many of you have come across before. He seems to have been more popular in the American sort of literature on learning and teaching. But the reason I bring him up is because he's sometimes considered to be one of the sort of forefathers of learning by doing, at least, which we can therefore link to active learning. So he has a number of books. He was around about sort of turn of the century, I think most of the books were turn of the early 20th century, his books were published. And he was a philosopher, I think, by trade, is that right? And a pragmatist in the philosophical sense, in that he preferred to see the evidence of his theories before he put much stock in those theories. Anyway, his thoughts on education were that the schooling at the time, traditional schooling, was more about preparing workers for a life of drudgery, so of accepting authoritarian rule, and not to make them think for themselves and be ethical citizens and so on. So that's what he was kind of railing against. And I just want to bring this up a little bit here, partly because of something that Elizabeth sent to Steve when she saw the topic of this talk. In the curriculum for excellence for the schools here, there was a lot of talk about active learning. And what Elizabeth told us was that this resulted in kids being let to run around the playground, let run around the classroom, and not actually have any structure or learning to it. So it was largely misunderstood, this idea that active was taken in a very literal sense, that it wasn't about being mentally active, it was about being physically active, right? This idea that you learn better if you're jumping up and down on the spot. So it was kind of misunderstood, but if you go back to what Dewey and others have said previously, he stresses that imagination, in other words, using the brain, is as much a part of our human activity as the muscular movement. So he's talking very much about the sort of mental movement, the mental activity. So this is what he thought. This kind of sums up his take on how active learning should run in schools, that basically we need to get rid of what he calls scholastic approaches, sort of the didactic approach to learning. And it should be that we want to arouse thoughts in people, not necessarily impart words, not impart facts and figures. So he observes, or he reckons, that the methods that formal education has relied upon are those that actually ape the way that people choose to learn, or just learn naturally outside of school. So it's about creating activities that demand thinking rather than having them sort of learn facts. So I think that's the kind of stuff we can all get behind. It's when you look at the curriculum for excellence, it actually doesn't talk very much. It talks about spontaneous play, but mostly it's about running, testing hypotheses, designing experiments, establishing investigations, undertaking creative work, and so on. So where this misunderstanding about active learning has come from, I'm not entirely sure. So Dewey talks a lot about learning from trial and error. Again, by being actively sort of constructing your own meaning. So the idea is that we might sort of try and take something, some material in play or in work, and then build something with it, and note the interaction between our intentions and those materials. So in other words, we're building up the understanding ourselves. So that's where he comes out from being unscholastic. You can tell I'm slightly underprepared for this. let me see. I like this quote at the bottom because the way that he says that we learn in natural settings is to do with, it requires interest, effort, and direction. Now he says things in different places about the efforts. The energy comes from both the learner but also from the teacher as well. But I thought this description was good, that even if they're not doing controlled experiments, this active learning is really about squinting at things, rattling and thumping. And for some reason, those of you who know Steve, that made me think of his attitude to life. You know, he's always rattling at things, thumping at things, thinking about how they work and how they might not work and how they might be improved. So I like that little quote. Finally, yes, this is the thing, this is one of the more famous quotes, I think. Ideas cannot be handed over like bricks. So giving students ideas, concepts, in a sort of like brick by brick sense, without knowing why they're important, or providing them with the tools or the opportunity to sort of construct something with those bricks and understand why they're important, is why that approach would not work. That brings me on to James Paul G. Is anyone familiar with James Paul G? Yes. Hi, you can come again, Sarah. So James Paul G is sort of one of the sort of the grandfather of game-based learning, which, as many of you know, was my research area. He's come from he's a literacy professor, actually, so he's not a sort of a native of this land. He's based at, I think, Arizona State University, where he's a literacy professor. But he became interested in learning from games after he observed, I think it was his son playing a game, and he devised these 36 learning principles that he observed in games that he thought that could be applied in a successful classroom. And the first of these 36 is the active and critical learning principle. And the way he defines that is that all aspects of the learning environment, and he words these so that they can apply to games but also into classroom environments, including the way the semiotic domain, the subject area, is designed and presented, are set up to encourage active and critical, not passive learning. So for G, he thinks that active learning occurs whenever we experience the world in new ways. So it's not just about learning facts, it's about seeing how those would change our viewpoint on the world. Forming new affiliations, lots of the active learning stuff talks about the social interactions that go along with it, and the preparation for future learning. So the example he gives there is that the problem solving that you encounter in games might be useful in later life, for example. So I think that is all I wanted to say about G. There are some other connections that I could waffle on about there, like the discovery principle. He's very big on this idea that people go out and experiment and find things out for themselves, and that's why he thinks the active learning part is important.
Do you not think preparation for future learning is also, and I'm just playing that, but I mean, it's also well served just by learning some stuff, because you need to understand that before you go on to the next piece.
In terms of learning the content, and then you understand the next piece of content. Oh yeah, I think that's probably true, but it's also those words will stick better if you know how to use them in a way, and then you're better off. You've built a stronger foundation for the next layer.
Preparation for future learning is also a part of non-active learning, but it's particularly
exactly. Yeah, I don't think he's saying that it can't occur without that. I mean, he's a literacy professor. I'm sure he knows a quote or two. You know, he must have to memorize the odd bit of stuff. The other thing that G points out, and this is where I'll probably become unstuck because there's some physicists here, but is he has this example of what he thinks, and he takes it from the G paper, I think, or from G's work that Steve's going to talk about in a minute, and he describes this idea that someone can have a passive understanding of the laws of physics, say Newton's laws of movement. This is where, see, I'm embarrassed now because I'm in front of some physicists. I was terrible at physics. But the idea is that if you ask a passive learner, someone who's had a shallow learning experience, they will be able to rhyme off the laws of physics as defined by, say, someone like Newton, but they won't have that deep understanding. And he said the example he gives is that someone throws a coin up into the air and you ask a student who has the sort of the shallow, sort of passive take on what is happening there, you ask them what forces are acting on the coin, they'll say that there's gravity, yes, but also something like the force that's in the hand throwing it up. Now, physicists, am I right in saying, yeah, that it's really just gravity that at that point is the only force that is working on it? And that's the kind of sort of understanding that G thinks that having a more active approach to a more to learning the principles, rather than learning the principles of as a set of sort of things by rote, he thinks that a better answer would come from someone who had learned that from an active sense. We can come back to that later. I can see you're pondering. Anyway, so that's what I wanted to say about G. Just very quickly, the paper that was the sort of reading material for this week, I'll summarise very quickly. So Sanders and so on, they did a survey of the literature, but also did a little survey of the computing science education community. And what they found from that survey of the community was that active learning is good, right? But not a lot more detail beyond that. There's a belief that somehow it is good. I think they had something like 200 and something responses to the question of what is a characteristic of CS education that will result in a good outcome for the student, and more than half of them said active learning. But the term isn't very well defined. The best thing they could boil it down to in an initial pass was something like that it was not a lecture, so something other than a traditional lecture. Really what they were describing, and actually the paper falls into this exact same trap, even though they kind of signpost it, is that where people describe the instructional techniques used rather than student learning, so it's more about active education than active learning, perhaps. And that all active learning techniques are treated equal, and of course, they will all have different effects. They attempt to at least sort of pin down what active learning means. This is one of the neatest definitions they give, something that involves students in doing things and thinking about the things they are doing. So that connects back to what Dewey was saying about giving students something to do so they can sort of make the connections for themselves. That's a very long quote, which I'll let you digest later on. But basically, this is just setting up the fact that active learning is somehow in contrast with the passive learning, where it's simply an instructor standing at the front of the room. And the key elements of it are student activity and the engagement in the learning process. What's maybe missing from this quote is things like the social aspects and the need for reflection. Anyway, they boil down all of these different takes on what instructional techniques go along with active learning, and they have four dimensions that they can place them on. First of all, it's how active are they? And what do they do? What do they actually do? I don't want to talk about that. Yep. So they have they identify some computing science education tasks or activities that have very minimal activity, and that includes just-in-time teaching. So Rose is nodding. So like, you sort of set them the homework, they prepare, you look at something, they may do some online exercises, and you can gauge what needs to be covered just in time. Is that about right? Okay, cool, we're on the same page. And maybe something like online discussion forums in Moodle or something, that's what they consider to be minimal activity. I think that sounds a bit pejorative in that clearly that's actually the just-in-time teaching I'm a big fan of, and it has lots of other benefits, but in terms of activity in the classroom, it's relatively low. So other tasks or other activities they describe as having some activity would be things like the think, pair, share. You know, when you pose a problem, students try and solve it themselves, and they talk to the person next to them. Peer instruction and so on. Then moving up the activity, they have something like pair programming. They seem to be very big fans of pair programming in terms of it's very active, and also it means that you can be more certain that all the people involved are bringing something to the table, whereas, you know, if it's just one person at the front of the room that's being, say, doing some live coding, then you can't be sure about the other people in the room that they're engaging. And then the highest level of activities they thought were associated with things like problem-based learning or long-term projects. In terms of how reflective they are, they pointed out a problem with this, that reflection isn't really, clearly when you say active learning, you don't see, reflection doesn't jump out of that, it's never really attached to the definition, so sometimes it's lost. And the other problem with the reflection is that how do you evidence it, right? It's easy to see if people are talking amongst themselves, you can see activities going on, or they're producing posters, or they're taking part in a sort of online survey, you can see the activity, but it's very hard to sort of see the reflection. So some of the low reflection techniques they identified in CS were things like just-in-time teaching again, but also live coding for the reasons I've just sort of mentioned. And other techniques were things like games and discussion forums, because they felt that their reflection wasn't necessarily required. They thought that the think, pair, share and peer instruction were a little bit more reflective, but they thought that the problem-based learning and things like cognitive apprenticeship involving a mentor clearly are going to involve a little bit more reflection. Basically, they come to the conclusion, I think, or they imply that pair programming is one of the best techniques because whatever you do, it's like you can bring a horse to water, but you can set these things up for active learning, but it won't necessarily happen if the students don't take part. Then there's the social aspects. So it's pretty clear what techniques that we can use that involve some sort of social aspect. The way in which they differ is, does the social interaction take place face-to-face? Versus online, is it long term or is it short? So a short one might be talking to your neighbour, long term would be a project that spans the semester. But also whether the social interaction is with your peers or not. By and large, all the techniques they list are with peer interaction, except for maybe the cognitive apprenticeship where a mentor is involved. And finally, how specific to computing are they? So a lot of the techniques that they highlight have been inherited from other disciplines, with the possible exception of something like pair programming and very specifically set up software engineering projects. They talk about legitimate peripheral participation, which we're big fans of in the apprenticeship program, but also authentic activities. So they think that the better active tasks in CS education are those that reflect the authenticity of actual software development.
Matt, does any of the literature suggest you would change how you assess?
The outcomes are still the same. Do you mean assess the learning
Yeah, so how would you assess? Would you assess, is all the literature proposing you assess learning in the exact same way? You have the same exam if you're going with that method?
Well, you should just learn more, you should just do better, it's presumably in whatever assessment you've got, if the assessment's appropriate. I don't think that, I haven't really seen active learning be associated with a particular style of assessment.
I would have thought potentially you would maybe change your learning outcomes slightly and potentially your assessment.
I don't think there's a logical need for that, but I think it's likely in the sense that to assess adequate and deep learning you're actually going to require them
to not verbatim,
yeah,
just
exactly.
Go over gravity, for example.
Right. So I think my own attitude to the review paper was, I admired the agenda it set, about being unhappy with the term, the enormous vagueness in the field, and suggesting those four different ways one might look at differences in active learning. It made me think that maybe computer scientists were worse than anyone else, but as you'll see, other heroes have said exactly the same thing about lack of definition in the literature. I'm just going to keep control of this. I've been having my ear bent over the last week by Joe's latest learning activity, brings up various points, but we can't dwell on them today. Now, one of the issues, one of the most fundamental issues, though, just to raise a flag, is even with the whole idea of activity, which I first ran across in studying Diana Lorillard's theory of the learning and teaching process, where she lists in her 91 book 12 activities, all of which are desirable in a course. And one of the difficulties in dealing with that is whether to take the word activity as something that's external and observable, which is very convenient for research, but doesn't get at the point that the activity you really care about is inside the learner's head where you can't get at it, and that's not only a theoretical possibility, but it's clear that as learners develop their ability at learning, they start to do silently in their head stuff which no longer needs an external activity but maybe did need it at first. So for example, now when I listen to a talk, my head is instantly, and without me thinking I should be doing this, thinking about possible objections to what they're asserting. But that isn't necessarily natural. After all, when people tell you something, particularly if it's low-level information, you don't necessarily do that. So one of the things you pick up during education is to be able to do some of these activities automatically, and that just makes it even harder for researchers. Okay, so I want to introduce something that some of you will probably find handy to refer to, which is Mickey Chee's framework. But I just put up that quote, which she opens one of her important papers by saying, active, constructive and interactive, these are her terms, are terms commonly used in the cognitive and learning sciences. However, they're not explicit about how they're defined. So it's clearly not computer scientists particularly bad. It's just as bad in psychology and education. Mickey Chee, I think, is Indonesian originally, but her career has been in USA universities. She's worked on a variety in that period, 89 to 08, so what's that? That's 20 years, on a variety of learning designs. So this is the stuff that's relevant here. Mostly in maths and physics topics, although her Experimental participants were often university students who had done physics in high school but not since. So it's, you can think of them as the kind of people we get arriving at the door in level one. She usually used having them just work with a textbook as her control group and looked at various interventions and measured how much better they did. So after that length of time, she realised that not all these interventions were provably better than just working with a textbook, but they weren't all equal, and that she was using this really to structure the last two decades of her research. And she noticed that she could order the terms of the size of the benefit into three types, which she originally called active, constructive, and interactive. And then in 2014 she... Is this jumping? Yeah. So originally she had these three categories. If you read the Sanders et al. Review we were talking about, Sanders calls those all active learning, and to distinguish them, that she's active is active only, as opposed to plus value. In 2014, she realised you couldn't get the point across in a slogan if you didn't have a term for non-active learning, so she introduced a passive form. There are actually a number of different non-active kinds you can see commonly in classrooms of various kinds. So. Besides her three favoured positive interventions, it's probably important, at least for people working in HCI and the more naive kind of school teacher, to realise that a child who's pushing a button mindlessly is not being active in any educational sense. You can have physical interaction that doesn't help at all. Passive is just listening, but there's also, of course, people who are completely inattentive or indeed absent, either mentally or physically. What are you saying?
Just avoid touching that.
So, just a postscript on her, she's more recently done two other things that are worth knowing about, although they're not narrowly relevant to this talk. One of these is that watching videos, having two learners working in a pair with a worksheet, watching a video of an expert tutorial between an expert tutor and a student can actually be about as valuable as if they'd been the one in the tutorial able to ask questions. And that's very shocking for those of us who believed that personal tutoring was the gold standard and that we had all sorts of theoretical explanations why it should be true, like being able to adapt explanations individually to the learner. Then, and those who like to make videos on their courses want to pay attention to this, in 2017, she showed that if the video shows a dialogue, this is more valuable from the point of view of learning than if the video shows a monologue, and that's true both when you compare pairs of learners watching a video, of the two kinds of video, or watching it singly. So that's interesting. The only comment I want to make immediately is the magic of peer interaction appears to be wider and more various than even I had appreciated before. Seems to bring out all kinds of things. In fact, I'll just say that it's hard to overemphasize that. When I was reading Cardinal Newman's book, The Idea of a University, this is written 150 years ago or so, it's very interesting to see how educational ideas we're barely able to internalize now have got, many of them have got interesting forerunners there, but he has a very interesting phrase buried somewhere in the middle. He said, if, no really, only if, the choice was between a university that consisted of professors and exams, or one where there was no tutoring and just peers interacting, it would be more educationally valuable just to have peers interacting. Of course, you think some combination might be even better. Okay, so... So following on from Chi's ICAP framework, that is that there are different kinds of active learning, all of which are useful, but some are more useful than others, then what would be my way of rephrasing that or integrating it with other ideas? So it's not really the physical, there's little a benefit from merely receiving or recalling stuff, it's about processing, transforming knowledge. Mathemogenic is an artificial word, introduced but not really taken up. Students hate it because they can't spell it immediately, but its virtue is it says exactly what we care about rather than the usual sloppy language. That is, we're interested in activities that generate learning, not activities of anything else. We care about what generates learning. Now, if you piece together other bits of the psychology and educational literature, particularly literature on revision techniques in university students, then going from low effectiveness to high effectiveness, it goes something like this. A lot of students reread stuff just before the exam and they highlight, they feel they've been active, but you can't measure any difference between rereading alone and rereading with highlighting. That doesn't do it. And that's probably because why rereading is poor is it's just recognition. You recognise the words, you know you've read them before, you feel a bit better, but nothing new happens. Better, and Quinton has students re-verifying this, is actually testing yourself. That is, set yourself a question and attempt to answer it out of memory. And that at least exercises recall. But more powerful than that is transforming your notes into another representation. I had a student many years ago in an undergraduate project who was interested in mind maps, which she thought was probably a huge advance. But the actual results were more interesting but different from that. What mattered was whether the student translated into a mind map from bullet points or from a mind map into bullet points. It's the change in the representation caused more learning, because of course you have to think when you do a translation, you have to think what it really means. Actually, in the same ballpark is one of the very high performing students in psychology. She was a mature student when she came, and like many mature students, she was very insecure about whether she had the brains for higher education. She didn't have any real problem with brains, and she worked much harder than the rest, and not surprisingly, she did better. But what she mentioned as standard practice for her was to endlessly rewrite her notes, and each time they'd be a bit shorter. So she'd probably have rewritten every note in every lecture, maybe 20 times, between when she heard it and when the exam was. But of course, contracting it is transforming it. Applying knowledge to new examples. But as some of you know, and only a few undergraduates grasp, one of the most powerful techniques is to try and teach someone else the concept. Naturally, it's not very different from writing an essay for someone else. So many of us know that we may feel we know something, so we'll write a paper about it, and then it's a struggle writing the paper because things we thought we knew, you come to cast some of the sentences come and some others don't. So for me, I know it's a good technique to produce examples, but actually it turns out I can't always produce examples, and that's a sign, of course, that I haven't really processed very deeply, but doing it, of course, helps me do better. I should just say how powerful that is in many ways. So here are many different little indicators of the same thing. So surgeons, medical surgeons, have this slogan they laugh at, but nevertheless have all been trained about new surgical procedures. The rule is you see one, you do one under supervision, and then you teach one. And when you think about that, what a lot of educational wisdom is packed in there. So probably when you're seeing it, you're just getting an overview of it and some perceptual learning. When you're doing it under supervision, you're focusing on the manual skills. But what's the teacher doing? They're maintaining the overall structure, and you can't teach it unless you can not only do the parts but also keep an eye on the overall procedure, on unwanted branching paths like incipient errors and things. All of that requires more of an overview. That's just one example, but another is, I learned this when I was an MSc student. I did a conversion computer science degree at Manchester, which was then arguably the best computer science department, and I had a very young supervisor who once told me, when he was even newer, this was just before term began in September, he was sitting in his office, and in burst the senior professor saying, "The students are coming next week and I still haven't got that assembler working, just help me, Chris." And he talked non-stop for a quarter of an hour without letting Chris say a word, and then stopped and said, "Thank you, thank you," and ran off to fix it. And it's the same business. So there are two points. I think that illustrates very well that attempting to tell someone else, they just have to look as if they're listening. You just have to act as if they were listening. But the real benefit is almost all in producing the explanations. And then, of course, one might, well, I say, of course, you can sit down to deliberately try and expand connections between what you've partly learned and other areas, like what are the apparently contradictory bits of evidence, what are apparently supporting kinds of evidence, very hard to think about both of those at once, what are examples in everyday life, and so on and so forth, the different types of links. And you can, if you care enough or are keen enough, you can attempt to deliberately pursue those. So roughly speaking, from a rather different angle on different sets of experimental evidence, that's something like a progression of activities that help the individual.
So Steve, just go back to that science thing. Are you saying that that's, I don't know, in the development of computer science will be solving more and more problems that strengthen every problem has a different set of connections out to the core concepts? You see it in so many different ways that you get things like physical structure, no function, no structure, no function. I mean, it's like when you dissociate that concept from all the examples, because you've seen so many, that you really deeply understand the concept.
I see it as slightly different. I mean, more connections is always good, but I think my own personal definition of deep learning is it's more about the number of different types of connection. Oh yes, we want cheap learning, don't we? No. Yes, that can be important. But of course there's all this stuff on this notion that it takes 10,000 hours of doing what you love best in order to become something like a world-class expert in it. I mean, there's no big shortcuts. I think it's probably, one's time is limited. I think probably really why I got to love physics in the first place, and my first degree was in physics, is because at school I was in the art stream, and you had to do physics, but it was taught at a slower pace, and that meant I could think about one day's little lesson at length on the bus going home. Of course, it's my choice, I thought about the physics rather than the English lesson at that point. But that's why, how much you love it,
sentence, less active than engaging in deliberative learning. So it's very hard to instrumentally define how what active learning would be in this case, because one thing that is quite at the bottom or like at the beginning of your list might require more energy or time.
But you could do number five without it requiring much time or energy. There's lots of ways of teaching that aren't writing an essay.
So it's hard to say, yeah, the relationship between this and active learning.
Oh, well, I think activity is about the mental processing, not the physical. And I think some pay off more, probably, per unit time. But, of course, what you're better to do depends on your interest.
So we're missing that.
Well,
the cognitive reinforcement framework that we're talking about.
Yeah.
That's not a good point, though. If you're going through the kind of passive system, and then you're selected to this active manner and you're going to succeed in this passive system, then it's unnecessary expense. Unless you're saying that someone, say, who receives some training that is helpful from, if he receives a passive lecture, he's definitely an active lecture.
I think maybe part of the power of peer interaction is that a lot of peer interaction occurs when people aren't thinking this is time for learning. You know, someone says something and they react to it.
It occurs to me that we might be kind of missing out on one fact, and it's related to what you say about the assessment, because we're not making any distinction between hard and soft knowledge. I'm just thinking, your example about surgeon, it actually has different dimensions that we are not talking about at all. So it involves different skills when you cut someone open. And we are not kind of delineating that. I don't know how we can. So from that point of view, we want to test all these things. We might actually want to test it in a different way to see, are you thinking, can you ride a bicycle? Do you know what the internal engine, you know, I mean the combustion engine works? Do you know what the software is cheating the emission works?
Is it different to your nature?
Well, there are lots of different things, and they may be all kind of correlated or somehow linked, but they're not the same thing.
But lots of these things do seem to make an assumption that it's very intellectual learning, but I mean, or they just spend a lot of time practicing physical learning because it's very each of the subject they're going to do. And when I was demonstrating in life sciences, I found it was really noticeable when we cut the amount of first year lab time, the second year students were suddenly much more incompetent with the scalpel than they had been before. So they missed out on a physical bit of learning that's vital for a biologist.
I think also, to your point, some of these aspects might be done by peer instruction. You know, in all cases, but in some cases, you will be creating new examples to explain it, and you may, one of the participants may be trying to explain it to another, so it potentially make other connections. So potentially your peer instructions may go through some of these aspects to help in the process, but all these sorts of topics.
I think it's true. I think, though, that things may be, you're quite right, of course, that in some sense perceptual is different from motor, is different from conceptual. But I think what may be in common is just, there may be more than you think. So suppose if I took that surgical slope and applied it to another area, I still think it's likely to work. Although it brings up other aspects which I hinted at about when you have to need to focus on detail and when on the overall connections. And when you're teaching someone, you become more aware. You often obsess about how one slide links to another. But that isn't where you'd be if you're doing individual bits. Why do I think in another area? Because it's true that motor skills take a lot of time. But if you think of the difference between a beginning programmer and an expert programmer, the expert programmer's got so many patterns in their head, they can, you know, do in a minute what might take hours for someone else. That's why even changing an editor can really slow you up because your fingers have to be retrained in it, and that's a significant part of programming. It's just programmers seldom wish to sort of boast about the tremendous motor learning they have to do, but actually it matters quite a bit.
It seems to me that different discipline may have different sets of...
It may, but I suspect this is more general than it appears,
yes.
Although that's completely reasonable.
Teach, does that affect the method? I mean, I can't imagine that everything you're trying to teach can be done one way.
Yeah, it's difficult to say studying Shakespeare needs to be active.
No, but even in computing science, I could just imagine different materials working peer and others needing. You know, I can't see it being one peer by peer. I suppose.
What Steve is trying to get at here, I just did a search on microgenics, and interestingly, Steve's page comes up top. but it's just the amount of internal work that the activities you put out there are requiring somebody to do in their head, and that cuts across any subject or anything. And I think, broadly speaking, if you go down this set of items, they're encouraging more work inside the learner's head. So it's what activities can we use? Well, and so there's a general idea that the more work you're going to happen inside the person's head, the more learning will happen. That's what this is all founded on. And so basically whatever activities, I mean, you have no control over whether the person actually does anything, but the learning designs you come up with that require people to actually think deeply and chuck material around and draw on their long-term memory and bring in short-term and formulate ideas. I mean, all of those things are things that strengthen our learning. That's the idea. So I think that cuts across with particular concepts we're trying to...
It is. But I think there's two things. One is I'm much more in love with extremely general ideas, so that's what you're getting some faith here from me. But I think it's also true that teachers are typically stuck too much on the nitty-gritty and can't see how it's similar to something else. So I don't know where in the middle is actually, as it were, a balanced view. Well...
Oh, he's not,
is
he?
No, of course not.
Too late.
Of course, I'll be setting homework in the exams next week. So everything I was talking about up to then are really individual gains, even if they're used for social stimulus. But there can be, when you look at some of the activities people use successfully in teaching, there can be some real, genuine social gains. Very broadly speaking, stuff that's about building a learning community, that is, getting a set of students in a new class used to the idea of using each other as a resource. So, Joe's activity, for instance, was a form of jigsaw, a form of dividing the class, getting each team to do a separate piece of research and then for all of them to communicate what they found to the rest of the class. And that's one example. But actually there are probably a lot of aspects potentially to genuine social gains rather than vague words about community. Part of it would be, of course, that once they start talking, they're likely to carry that on. They're more likely to do that outside the class, at least if you shape things in a good way. I just want to point out another very obvious but under our nose sense. When psychologists say peer comparison, they're talking about when people compare what they're doing to someone else, as in, he's got more muscles than I am, he's got high marks than I don't, stuff like that. And that, I think it's important to realise that although some of that is malign, it's very important. Learners can't trust really what most teachers say about their marks, because teachers have completely unrealistic expectations. It's much more informative to know you're in the top 10% of the class or the bottom 10% or something if you're on the bottom 10%, you know there are a whole lot of people in the same room who are doing better than you, and it's not just the teacher thinking she ought to be better or wants every, you know, wants to be unrealistic. It's very useful, that. But it's... And finally, so these are really not just different possible learning aims, but different kinds of learning aims. There's the individual and the social. But I just want to mention something which I don't think it... Sorry, yes?
No, I think it's really just what you were about to... The last point, which is
something else. You want to say it for me?
Yeah, so about the fact that it's the importance of synchronizing it, I think that's quite central, because... in a social learning context, like I consider that, you know, people come there as freshmen, they're, you know, some of them are introverted, very, you know, self-conscious, and having a very social learning is like, can, you can have all these different other impressions interfering with the learning. And especially if the learning is not synchronized, so there's, when it's clear that some people know more than you do, in my experience, I've seen people, feeling really subconscious bad about that. So, but they're willing to engage in social learning when they know that they're well prepared and relatively well off. So I think there are many like interactions to find whenever there's social peer learning.
No, and I think most of us aren't nearly self-conscious about thinking about that enough. You can't have a useful discussion unless everyone's in a similar place to begin that, and that requires synchronization. On the other hand, the opposite pole of that is that generally self-paced learning is so much better than synchronized learning. One of the many bad things about lectures, and even worse with videos, is the delivery is at a pace that's not in the learner's control, and that means it's almost always at the wrong pace, either too fast or too slow for that individual. I certainly, and this operates at all sorts of levels. So that's the difficulty, is that peer discussion requires synchronization, and otherwise unsynchronized learning is almost certainly best. So you'll never know how it ends.
I know.
So to summarise, I think the different classes of ILOs to think about for active learning kind of things in your class is what do you want to happen in terms of individual learning? What do you want to happen, if anything, in terms of social gains? But actually, there's some more I've noticed. So, for instance, in the activity Joe's just been doing, it seemed to me, listening to him, I don't know if he agrees with this, is that part of the reason he had this activity was because he needed to know more about the class. You know, you can't write a lecture that will work as a monologue and be successful unless you've got quite a good idea about where they are, or to put it in constructivist terms, if you don't know where the student's starting, you can't adapt your abstract knowledge to fit their misconceptions or their prior knowledge. And quite a lot of these active learning things actually give the teacher a lot of information. It's also can be good for student diversity, kind of diversity that Rose was talking about recently. So demonstrating actually to all the students what's interesting about other students' experience from a different background or angle. So penultimate thing. Elizabeth sent me some photos of current advice about active learning in schools, and the thing that I realised wasn't in any way related to by this talk, so here it is that one element of this advice to teachers on active learning is there has to be active teaching. So this is the last slide, and if you wanted to do something practical on the basis of this talk, then I think the first thing is that despite the lack of precise definitions, it's not true that one piece of active learning is similar to another in its effects. There are definite differences. Qi, in a constrained way, was able even to classify that to some extent. But probably if you introduce an activity, it might, because so many of our aims are actually not, they're not fully explicit to us, I'd probably recommend privately writing down your actual intended learning objectives and realise they're going to be of several different kinds. So the normal kind about individual learning and raising exam results is only one class of those, probably. Secondly, when you design a typical classroom activity, you're designing what you're going to do in class, but that's simultaneously actually usually designed, not always, but more often than not, designing out of work preparation you're requiring them to do. And whether that's a good idea will depend on whether you're timing this in a way that they can actually do that or not. Well, there's also that, but even before that, there's a question about whether you very cleverly done it in the first session where they can't possibly have had other homework unless this idea gets out. And then the synchronous is another thing to point out. Right.
Yes, you go on, sir.